Federal Insurance. Counsel, we're ready to hear you.
May it please the court. Good morning.
Good morning.
I am Brett Godfrey, and I represent Federal Insurance Company in this appeal. At issue here in this matter is the question of whether a clearly worded and unambiguous amendatory endorsement may be rewritten by the district court based upon the fact that it is inconsistent with other documents that had been issued prior to the policy which that amendatory endorsement purports to modify. Here we have a case in which a ski area developer known as IntraWest developed a number of ski area locations around the country, and in the course of its business sought to obtain what's called an owner-controlled insurance program. Now, part of the owner-controlled insurance program included coverage for things like workers' compensation and a fronting type of policy that was issued, but another component of that program was a standalone primary policy of third-party liability insurance that was issued by National Union as the primary insurer. My client, Federal Insurance Company, issued an excess policy of insurance which sat above the National Union policy. In the context of the case, we have claims against IntraWest Corporation that led to liability in excess of a single $5 million limit for products and completed operations coverage, which is the type of coverage typically applicable to construction defect litigation.
So you picked up the excess over five?
Yes, Your Honor, we did.
Your policy.
Yes, we did. Now, in the...
Now, was this known to the insured, or was this purely a intra-insurer situation?
In the underlying litigation, the insured was a party.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, at the time of the... the insurance issuer was just one issuer, with the excess being a relationship between the two of you?
No, Your Honor. The insurance that was afforded by the federal policy of insurance was separately contracted through the broker, Willis.
And was that issued as an umbrella, or how?
Well, it's actually called an excess umbrella policy, and it's got multiple layers to it, and it's got lateral, and I call them lateral endorsements. What I mean by that is that the second layer excess coverage is in many respects what we call follow form insurance coverage, but there are endorsements within that policy that broaden the footprint, and to that extent they would probably be properly characterized as umbrella coverage.
And the owner in controlled insurance program consisted of all of the policies in the wrap-up insurance, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The owner controlled insurance program was actually governed by contracts that include more than just insurance coverage. Those other contract documents, in fact, are a core focal point of the district court's analysis, in which the court looked at whether contract language for the broader program could be used to create an ambiguity in the policy of insurance itself. Now, the key to this case, I believe, is that the policy of insurance is, for purposes of this dispute, the only insuring document at issue. That policy states clearly on its face that it may not be amended by some collateral contract. It says plainly on its face, this policy may only be amended by an endorsement issued by the company and made a part of the policy.
If the schedules are part of the policy and we have to read the endorsement with the schedules, would you agree that there's an internal ambiguity?
No, Your Honor, I would not, for two reasons. A, they are not part of the policy, but even if they were, those schedules that are being referred to include a quote and a binder, and both of those, at best, are ambiguous. By that, what I mean is there's two sections. One talks about all projects, and one talks about per project. There's a $5 million aggregate policy limit that applies. And it states that it's both all projects and per project. The only way you could harmonize that language would be to understand that all projects mean that all of those projects have a per project $5 million limit, completed operations aggregate limit. That's like saying all the members of the armed forces have a uniform. Well, it's clear there's more than one uniform issued to the armed forces.
Well, I read this as saying that there was a $5 million completed operations aggregate, but that there was a $15 million general aggregate that related to other coverage other than completed operations?
That's correct, Your Honor. The $15 million general aggregate is arguably a separate aggregate. However, for purposes of this appeal, that's not an issue that the court need reach because the amount in controversy in this action is not in excess of that general aggregate. What is at issue in this case is whether the policy was clearly amended after it was issued.
Only if we agree with you that it's not part of the policy.
Right. Well, I would differ with that respectfully, Your Honor, because even if it had been part of the policy...
On that point that Judge McHugh asked you about is, Judge Brimmer didn't treat it as an amendment, did he, in his analysis?
He did not, and there's a well-settled line of case law cited in our briefs, including the Martinez case and the White's case, which say that a subsequent amendment of a policy, even if it is in conflict with the earlier language of the documents that it amended, still trumps. It does not create an ambiguity to amend a policy of insurance. And more importantly, Judge Brimmer found no ambiguity, none whatsoever, on the face of amendment of endorsement 9, which was issued significantly later in time than the policy issuance or the binder issuance. It's well settled in Colorado law that the issuance of a policy supersedes and utterly replaces the binder. It's also well settled in Colorado law in the Martinez case and the White's case that when an amendment is issued after the policy is in place, it is given its meaning, even if it changes the original policy, which it would have to do. A mandatory endorsement can only do that.
Declarations page is part of the policy, wouldn't you?
That is correct, Your Honor. And the declaration
says that the product completed operations aggregate limit is $5 million.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that aggregate applies.
And that would be consistent with the schedule. The schedules also say the aggregate for completed operations is $5 million.
They do say that. But the amendment issued after both of those says that that aggregate policy limit applies separately on a per-project basis. So that's the key language. It was issued as a negotiated instrument.
Well, it isn't your position, is it, that the court looks at the endorsement alone and doesn't look at anything else with respect to the policy?
Absolutely not. That is not my position.
Okay, so...
However, it is my position that to the extent that the endorsement as an amendatory endorsement changes what the policy would have said in its absence, then you have to treat that as a change. It does not have to be...
What if it's absurd? What if the policy before the endorsement was a $5 million aggregate, and if you interpret it the way that you suggest, it's a $532 million aggregate? I can't remember.
Well, that takes you back to the $15 million general aggregate, so I don't think you'd get to that. But the other side of the issue is...
Well, no, you didn't answer my question. I mean, is the court supposed to look at if the interpretation that you're suggesting just isn't believable in the context of what it would mean?
If this were a case where you had an absolutely absurd result, it would be different. But this is not an absurd result.
So you have an endorsement that extends, I think, for 5 years, or is it 10 years? I can't remember.
The occurrence extension is 10 years.
For completed operations, and it charges $350,000 for that 10-year extension. And in your view, it took the policy from of an aggregate coverage of $5 million to an aggregate coverage of $355 million for a premium cost of $350,000.
Well,
that's your position.
No,
right?
It's not. It's not. My position is that, first of all, the premium was quoted by National Union based on its own underwriting principles, and it had a decision to make, and it made a decision. It entered a contract. The other issue to keep in mind is that in the briefing papers on summary judgment before the district court, it was explained, and this is part of the record, that the reason we get to such a high potential risk, assuming we ignore the general aggregate, which I don't think the court necessarily need do here.
Well, completed operations and is insuring projects that are complete for a period of time after you, for example, you have a certificate of occupancy, right?
That is correct.
So they insure different things, don't they?
They do, but the question here is, how did we end up with this result and why is it commercially reasonable? Well, first of all, the cases cited in our briefs show that the commercial reasonableness issue cannot be used to rewrite a clearly worded policy or a clearly worded amendment to the policy. Secondly, the underlying briefing papers make clear that it was after this was issued, there was litigation in 2005 between the carriers and the insured, and pursuant to that, the list of insured locations was drastically increased as a part of settlement of a bad faith claim against National Union. So the consideration it received for this potentially large amount of coverage was far in excess of just the premiums paid. It was inclusive of what at that time was a very potent and high-risk bad faith case that went away in exchange for adding a long list of insured locations to that policy. So the consideration and the commercial reasonableness cannot be viewed in a vacuum just based on the premium number that was quoted. If it pleases the court, I'd prefer to reserve the rest of my time.
No problem.
Good morning, Your Honors. Matthew Fink, representing National Union Insurance Company. I'd like to respond directly to some of the points made by Federal, but first I'd maybe just go back to fully explain what an OSIF is. I think some of it may get some confusion to that.
Well, let's start with not using acronyms.
Okay.
So what is OSIF?
It is an owner-controlled insurance program. So it's when you have a large construction. They're building large condominiums.
I think we understand that.
Okay.
It's just OSIF I did pick up on.
Okay. So what it does
is... What happens is all of us, we're as guilty as the next person.
I appreciate
using lingo, and before you know it, we're telling jokes by number.
I appreciate that, and I apologize. I'll try not to do that. So the owner-controlled insurance program is for large construction projects like this where they're building condominiums on one location. They may have two different projects going on. It tries to bring all the... You have many different subcontractors, 20 different subcontractors, general contractor, a developer. Rather than each having their own separate insurance policies, you issue one tower of insurance that will cover all the contractors. That's what happened here. There was a tower of insurance of $80 million. National Union had the first $5 million. Federal had the next $10 million. But then there was coverage by other insurers, including Federal higher up to $80 million of coverage here. All the claims didn't even come close to reaching $80 million.
But did National have $15 million on the general aggregate on part of the insurance policy?
Yes, and I think it was confused when counsel was talking about the general aggregate, because what the general aggregate means in the context of the policy and the schedules and the proposal is for ongoing operations. That was for general aggregate for ongoing operations. That's the $15 million. So that's if someone slips and falls during the construction of it. But once it's completed, as Your Honor indicated, then you go into the completed operations coverage. And that had a different set of limits. It had $5 million per project and a total all locations aggregate of $5 million, which was different than the ongoing operations. The ongoing operations had $5 million at each location, but then a total aggregate for all locations of $15 million, which really undercuts Federal's argument completely, because they cannot come up with an explanation, and this is what District Court Judge Brimmer found, that there was no reasonable explanation offered by Federal as to what the $15 million all-location aggregate meant.
Their argument, as I understand it, is that you don't get to look at that schedule at all because it's not contained in the policy, and Endorsement 9 on its face is not ambiguous.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the district court agreed that if you just look at Endorsement 9, it's not ambiguous and it's clear in favor of Federal.
Well, 2 points. The district court did not say it was ambiguous. It just said it was questionable what that meant. He didn't know what separately per project meant. But he also said you do need to look at the entire contract, which is the law of Colorado. And here, going back to what the OSIF is, it's a very unique contract. It says right in the indemnity agreement, it's a unique contract, a single contract made up of the schedules, the indemnity agreement, and the policies.
Excuse me. What counsel is asking us to do is to segment the policy and to interpret the coverage here by referring only to one part of it, the endorsement, and not paying any attention to any of the rest of the policy.
Correct.
Was that the understanding at the trial court level?
Yes, that was the same argument they made in the trial court level. And it is an integrated contract. Colorado law is clear that you could have integrated contracts with several different documents making up a single contract, and that's what we have here. So you do need to look at the entire contract. You can't look at...
Well, there's nothing peculiar about Colorado law in that regard. Is there? I mean, is there a dispute among the jurisdictions on that point?
No, Your Honor. I think that's basic black-letter law pretty much everywhere, but we just cited Colorado law on that. So I think the fallacy of their argument is to only focus on the schedule and say you're not allowed to look at the whole contract. And the whole contract does include the schedules, the indemnity agreement, and for good reason, because there's many things in that schedule. If you just looked at the policy, you wouldn't even know what the premium is. I think, Your Honor, you mentioned the premium being $300,000. It was for that extended five-year period, there was an additional premium of $500,000. Well, that information is only contained in that schedule. Likewise, there was a $25 million SIR, self-insured retention, which means the insurer is going to pick up the first $25,000 for each habitual unit, which is essentially each condo unit. That information, that $25,000, is only contained in the schedule. So if you were to go under counsel's interpretation, you're only allowed to look at the policy, you wouldn't know what the premium was. You wouldn't be able to say, you wouldn't be able to enforce the self-insured retention. It's clearly there.
What do we do about the merger clause that says it can only be amended by endorsement?
I think 2 points there, Your Honor. One, no one, the district court in our position is not that there's any amendment here. The schedule, which says $5 million all locations, is consistent with what endorsement 9 says and the meaning of endorsement 9. We think it's clear on the face. It says endorsement 9 says there's one $5 million aggregate for the extended period. It's on the deck page. So we don't think there's any amendment here. It is consistent with what the endorsement 9 says. Second, I think the whole premise of their argument here is that after the proposal, which clearly listed a $5 million all locations aggregate, after the binder clearly listed $5 million all locations, after an email which went out before the binder was said, you know, they asked the question, is this per project or is this a total limit? And this is the May 13th, 99 email. Mr. Hall clearly said this is all total limits. You get $5 million total. So this was the deal from the beginning. What counsel says, there's some negotiation or change, and I think the district court correctly went through the extrinsic evidence, which is only the contemporary writings at the time, to find out what was the meaning of how did that language get into this endorsement. And I think the evidence, the record is clear how it got in there. Again, it was first, the question was asked of Mr. Hall about that, and in May 13th, 98 email, he answered clearly, yes, it could be separately, it could be per project, but you only get $5 million limit. And the reason that question was asked, you know, it's a little confusing, but if you go back to the proposal itself and that chart, for the ongoing operations, it said it listed per project ongoing operations $5 million, and then on the side, it said per project. There was a little note that said per project. So that was for ongoing operations. But for the completed operations, it did not say per project. So it was per location. So there's a question. You had examples where Mammoth, California, was one of the locations. So that's one location. It has two different projects on it. It has a Juniper Springs Lodge, which was a hotel and condominium project. And it also had what's called Sierra Star, which was townhomes. So there's two projects on the one location. I think InterWest just wanted clarification that if there was one large loss at one of these projects, a whole $5 million loss at Sierra Star, could we use that policy limit for Sierra Star, or does it have to be split between the projects equally? And the answer was you can use it per project, similar to, because if you go back to that email, the only question he asked is, can we have the same language per project similar to the general aggregate? because that was per project, not per location. And the answer was, yes, we can do that, but it doesn't change the limit. Now, stepping forward to March 2nd, 1999, almost 9 months later, Willis again sends an email. They get the policy, they get the schedule endorsement. It doesn't have a lot of language. It doesn't have the 10 years in there. It doesn't have that we're going to reinstate it annually, and it didn't have this language per project. So Mr. Riella writes to AIG and says, yeah, we need these changes. Mr. Riella was new on the file, so he didn't know, so he went to ask Mr. Hall, did you agree to this? And Mr. Riella actually forwards the 1998 email to him and says, look, you guys agreed to this language. So they said, yes, we agreed, again, to make it a per project instead of a per location, but it doesn't change the aggregate. So in essence, long-winded to get to is that this language that was ultimately put into the endorsement was not a change. It wasn't an amendment. It was simply codifying what they had said in that May 13th, 1998 email.
Let me ask you this. Colorado has case law that says that the court may not consider the party's own extrinsic expressions of intent.
Correct.
Was it proper for the district court to consider the declaration of Mr. Hall and some of the other evidence that it considered in making its decision here?
It was, Your Honor. I think the district court is very careful in what it took from Mr. Hall's affidavit as well as the other evidence. What the district court reviewed was contemporaneous evidence to give context to the whole contract, the context of what the meaning was.
Sorry. Not entirely, though. I mean, the emails are contemporaneous, but his declaration is not.
Well, there's several things he said in the declaration. The only thing the district court relied upon, I think, was paragraphs 12 and 13, which were essentially Mr. Hall recalling his conversation with Mr. Riella. So it was contemporaneous conversation that took place. Again, this goes back to when Mr. Riella got forwarded. He was asked, is this per project? And he said no. So then Mr. Riella forwarded him the 1998 email saying, say, look, you guys had already agreed to this. So he went to Mr. Hall.
Remind me, did Judge Brimmer declare an ambiguity before he turned to extrinsic evidence?
He did not. I think correctly under Colorado law, when he questioned what the meaning of the phrase was, that you could look to the extrinsic evidence, just the contemporaneous extrinsic evidence, to give context to the contract, to inform himself whether there is an ambiguity or not of the entire contract, not just that term, but when you look at it in the broad context of the entire contract, was there an ambiguity? And the conclusion he came to, which was the correct conclusion, was there was none.
Is there a modified parole evidence rule that you can turn to parole evidence for the purpose of determining whether there's an ambiguity, to determine whether you could consider parole evidence in resolving the ambiguity?
I think
very strange birds and ostrich.
Yeah, I think this is set out clearly in the two Supreme Court cases, KN Energy and I think Public Service case, that it is a question of, first it's a question of law as to whether there is an ambiguity, and the court is permitted to look at the context of the language to inform itself as to whether there is or isn't an ambiguity. And when the court looked at that, what it ultimately concluded was there was no request for a change here in the limits. So simply a change from going from a per location to a per project, and that was the only reasonable meaning of that term when you look at it in the overall context of the program here, which included the schedules.
And when we review, we're reviewing de novo,
correct.
Right? So if we were to say, you know what, there's an ambiguity here, that would make an issue of fact that it would have to go to the jury, wouldn't it?
I think, if you find that there's a ambiguity, it could be a question of fact. And I think, and there's cases of support, if ultimately the ambiguity is going to be resolved the same way that the court resolved it, looking at the same information, that it would be would not be effective to remand it then to have the same findings. But you're correct. And we think it's very clear that there is no ambiguity on the face of the contract. Just because the term in that one sentence in the endorsement 9 may be unclear, it doesn't make the entire contract ambiguous. You have to look at the entire contract. When you compare, and then you look at the history of what that meaning of that term is, but even just comparing what endorsement 9 with the schedules, which you have to do, we think it's clear on the face between those two documents that there wasn't all locations aggregate limit of $5 million. Again, Federal's argument that that all locations and per location or per project and per location mean the same thing is just unreasonable. It completely reads out, and that chart is very clear to me, but you have a per project aggregate of $5
million. So we can get all these arguments together and contain them. You're saying the contract is not ambiguous.
We think it is not ambiguous.
All right, and your colleague is also taking the same position, that it is not ambiguous.
Correct, Your Honor.
So if we were to conclude otherwise, we're kind of taking a different approach from that of the district court entirely.
Yes, Your Honor.
Contrary to your position and contrary also to the appellant's position.
Correct. And we think just a plain reading of the entire contract makes it non-ambiguous, as well as looking at the intrinsic evidence, which I believe is entitled to do. I mean, lastly, just on this point of the all locations, under Federal's reading of this, it essentially gives the same meaning of per project to all projects. And that would make that all project language completely superfluous. And we know that you have to give meaning to all terms of a contract. That's not a reasonable interpretation of that all project limit, and that's what Judge Brimmer ultimately found. And I'm right on time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Well done.
There are two key Colorado Supreme Court decisions that I think have to be taken.
Let's get on this ambiguity point. You don't want us to declare an ambiguity.
I think the policy is not ambiguous. I think Judge Brimmer was correct in finding that Endorsement 9 favors Federal's position. He found no ambiguity on the face of that. The closest he came was to say that with that amendment, the binder would be contradicted. The binder isn't part of this. The binder, by definition, is no longer a relevant instrument under any set of facts. In the Martinez versus Hawkeye case, the court held the language of an endorsement being the later expression of intent prevails if the language of the endorsement and the policy conflict. The rationale for that was laid out in greater detail in Simon versus Shelter, a 1992 decision of the Colorado Supreme Court, reiterated again in 07 by Weitz versus Mid-Century. The endorsement trumps, even if there's a conflict. Clear-cut Colorado law. Secondly, under the Hansen case cited in our briefs, you cannot go to...
Is there a Colorado case that says that the endorsement trumps where it is a narrowing of the construction of the underlying contract?
I believe all three of those decisions say exactly that, Your Honor. Also, the Hansen case says that you cannot go to extrinsic evidence to create an ambiguity. Now, in the court's initial analysis, Judge Brimmer looked at two decisions.
Well, that's irrelevant before us, because Judge Brimmer did not declare an ambiguity.
That is correct, Your Honor. But your de novo review, to guide this, I'd just like to point out that Judge Brimmer said, looking at this case called Memory 10 and another case called Cheyenne Mountain, right, he cited it in general abstract terms for the proposition that he can look extrinsically to see whether there's an ambiguity. But those decisions were neither of them insurance policy decisions, and both of them read differently than the court cited them. In the Memory 10 case, we have a computer company being purchased on an option agreement, and the court decided not to find an ambiguity based on extrinsic evidence, and in fact followed what we would see in the Shelter case, American Family versus Hansen case, which says that unless you find a reasonable reading on the face of the four corners of the policy that could go both ways, you don't have an ambiguity. You can't go to extrinsic evidence at that point. The Hansen case is a much later case. It's a Colorado Supreme Court 2016 case, and it stands for the proposition that these earlier decisions are erroneous. The methodology used by Judge Brimmer in this case was erroneous based on the clear-cut explanations from the Hansen case, and it cites a lot of other decisions starting on page 121 of that decision.
But the premise of your argument is that the schedule is not part of the contract.
That is a premise, but even if it were, it was amended, and it's okay to amend a policy. That's what the Martinez and the Whites and the Shelter case all say. You can change a policy. When this amendment was issued, it was issued because once the policy came out, the insured and the broker looked at it and said, this is not how we had interpreted that binder. So there was a lot of back and forth. And it's true that initially National Union resisted the change. But in return
The endorsement standing alone, does not even create insurance, does it? I mean,
no.
If I were to find this endorsement somewhere in a drawer...
By itself, it does not.
All by itself, and I looked at it, and I'd say, I wonder what this is. The last thing I would consider is that, this is an insurance policy.
Right? I agree. Absolutely
so
right.
How can you possibly take the position that Judge Brimmer should never have looked at the policy?
I did not take that position. He should look at the policy, but the policy was amended. And the amendment trumps any inconsistencies. By the way, there were no inconsistencies. But if there had been, the amendment would trump them and says this limit applies separately to each of the locations. That's clear.
Taking your argument that the endorsement is an amendment, you have an automatic ambiguity because the declaration says the most we will pay for completed operations is $5 million. If we read the endorsement that you want, the declaration and the endorsement are in conflict, aren't they?
They are not, because the endorsement is clear and says that limit, the most we will pay, applies separately per project. That's very clear. And even if there was a conflict, those decisions I cited recognize that such a conflict does not create an ambiguity as a matter of law. Such a conflict simply evidences a change in the negotiated language of the written contract. Plain on its face and unambiguous, must be enforced as written. Thank you.
You're welcome. Counsel are excused. Case is submitted.